This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to another Joy 94.9 podcast.
It's the Casting Couch on Joy 94.9 with Mark and Thomas. Now, it's been 5 years since a strange new little plasticine man named Harvey Crumpet endeared himself to us all. And now, with their much-anticipated follow-up feature claymation film, Mary and Max, it is my great pleasure to welcome to the Casting Couch producer Melanie Coombs and director Adam Elliott. Welcome to the Casting Couch, guys.
Good evening.
God, thank you so much for coming in today.
Great. Look, we're in the middle of a nationwide media blitz, and we're going from everywhere from, the morning show with Kate and, what's his name, Kim and...
David and Kim. Oh, boy, we really
David
we
and
got
Kim.
That wrong. Anyway.
It's been a flurry. Now, Adam, claymation has got to be the most painstaking form of animation in order to tell a story that you can possibly have picked. Why this medium? Why tell your story in plasticine, Adam?
Oh, I can't do anything else. I think there's something magical about stop-motion animation that even other forms of animation don't have. I think when an audience see these characters with fingerprints on them, yeah, they know that what they're looking at is real and tangible and tactile, and it hasn't been generated in a computer. And I remember when I graduated from film school about 12 years ago, the VCA down the road, a few people said to me that I was pursuing a dying art form and that digital technology would actually kill it. And if anything, we've gone through a renaissance. Stop motion animation is there's actually quite a few feature stop motions coming out this year.
How big an impact has the Aardman Studios had on stop animation? I mean, that must have been a huge boost for animation stop claymation all over the world.
Absolutely. I think they validated the art form. They actually brought it back in a way. I mean, it had always been there. It's been there since the birth of cinema. But I think it was sort of happening at the same time as CGI features were exploding everywhere. And it just reminded people that really, at the end of the day, it's the story that's the most important thing. And whether your character is a blob of plasticine or a CGI character generated from a computer, which, of course, there is a person behind that computer generating that image, that really is the story that's the most important thing at the end of the day.
Mm. One of the things Aardman did too was that they really kind of promoted... People doing claymation had mostly been working in other languages. Mm-hmm. And so in English, they really kind of, you know, brought claymation back into the fore. Whereas, you know, Disney and other the major animation studios had stopped. So that was what Aardman really did, I think.
Does using plasticine somehow ironically allow you to depict human nature more accurately than you would with actors, because you're able to manipulate every single expression, every single, you know, movement?
I think being a stop-motion director, we have more control than a live-action director. Yeah. And when you watch an animated short or feature or whatever, you suspend your disbelief immediately. You actually have to, right from that first frame, say, well, I know this isn't real, but I'll go with it. I'll believe that this blob is a real human being.
I think that's the key. You're not trying to trick people into thinking it's reality. I remember when the computer animation first started to become big, and things like the Final Fantasy film was trying so hard to look real, it completely distanced you. Mm, sure. Where exactly what you're talking about with the Wallace and Gromit characters and with your characters and a lot of the other claymation characters all over the world.
And we also
have authenticity to them.
Well, that's our aim too, is to make these blobs of plasticine as real and as authentic as possible. So if something horrible happens to them, you are moved, that you have empathy for these characters, and that's really tough to do. There are days where I think, gee, this would be easier if we were doing it in live action. It'd be quicker for a start.
Well, that's certainly yeah. And cheaper. But I think it also, you know, I've got this sort of theory that, you know, when you see, you know, say a film like Doubt, for example, well, Meryl Streep and Philip Seymour Hoffman, yeah, you have to spend, you know that they're real people outside of the drama, so you sort of suspend your disbelief once. But with animation, particularly stop motion, you have to do that doubly so, and I think it means that when you decide to invest, you doubly invest. And because you can project your own feelings and emotions onto something, you know, that's not real, might be harder to project onto an actor, So I think that that's partly, I mean, I know from our experience with Harvey Crumpet, the way in which people love Harvey, like it's kind of, they love him so much, you know, and I think it's partly because he's not got, he's a blank slate in some ways. And obviously we're hoping that you're all going to feel the same way about Mary and Max.
Oh, I have no doubt. It's a wonderful film. And I think there's an added appreciation there too, knowing just how many man hours went into the production of this. Give us some of the stats, Adam.
Actually, I did a corporate speaking event yesterday where I got up and told the audience, and I just worked it out beforehand, that we roughly did over 200,000 man hours. Women hours.
Yeah.
Gay hours. Lesbian hours. and someone else worked out, one of the crew, I don't know if this is true, but if I'd have made the film all by myself, it would have taken 225 years.
Which I would believe, yeah.
It's even too much for you. Now, you know, you have gone from making Harvey Crumpet, where, you know, you built the puppets, you animated the puppets yourself, to now directing a team of animators. How did you go making that transition?
Well, it was pretty tough because even though I'd called myself a director for all these years, I really was just directing myself and a couple of people who would help me build the puppets and sets. There was no other animators to direct. I'd always directed the actors, the voice cast, but nothing to this at this scale. And it was tough because I had to suddenly come up with a language. I had to work out what my style was. I never had to put that into words. And so we came up with a style Bible, which we gave everybody. And we had these two key words, chunky wonky, which it summed up my style.
Yeah. Chunky wonky. I saw them at the Big Day Out once. They were, good.
But it was also, I mean, we had to actually build a kind of a machine, a production machine as well. So, you know, not only was it not Adam animating, but it wasn't just one person, it was six people at once.
Yeah.
In 10 different studios with all of this sort of machinery around it. And one of the things that we did is we knew that, you know, Adam and I both share one quality, which is we're both control freaks, like in a good way.
You've got to be right for this medium, surely.
And so we had to build a system where, you know, things could be designed, Adam could approve the design. Things could be built, Adam could approve. You know, so we actually built all these checks and balances so that when you do see the film, it still feels like those characters are in Adam's style.
Absolutely.
Very clearly. So that sort of, you know, voice of the author is still very clear, which is great, you know.
In fact, that's so much the case that I was really surprised to learn that six animators worked on this project with you, because it is so in your style. It's fantastic. Now, guys, how did the collaboration between you two come about in the first place?
I saw Cousin, basically, and I went up to Adam and just...
One of Adam's previous short films.
Yeah, which is about his cousin who has cerebral palsy.
Yes.
And I didn't think I was particularly interested in producing animation per se, but I just thought it was such a wonderful story, and I thought it was just such a brilliant way at exploring disability that was completely not patronising, not syrupy, not saccharine, not politically incorrect, not anything. That it was just so honest, and it really resonated for me. And I thought, this is a storyteller I'm really interested in. Mm-hmm. So I went up to Adam and said, I really want to work with you. And, blah, 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 and he went, but he backed away slowly, frankly.
Yeah.
And then went on, and I'd said, you know, you need to be doing something bigger. You need a producer. It should be me, blah, blah, blah. And as I say, he backed away slowly, made another short called Brother, which was a huge success, despite my advice offering the contrary view.
Yeah.
And but then he decided that actually, you know, we'd got to know each other better in the meantime, and he'd realised I wasn't actually as crazy as I came across as, and also that probably we could do something wonderful together. So that was the beginning with Harvey Crumpet, and, you know, we worked out, you know, that Adam had, you know, the story, and I sort of started to kind of support that, and then, you know, financing it and making it was a you know, a 5-year journey in itself that culminated with the Oscar. Yeah, so I think that's sort of pretty much the story.
Yeah.
You want to contradict anything there, Adam?
No, that's how it all happened. Yeah. And I mean, the years have flown by. That's the amazing thing. I mean, at this rate, we're really only going to make two films a decade.
But so. Is that such a bad rate? I mean, I think that's still
that's
pretty impressive.
That's pretty good. Someone told us a while back that the average film worldwide takes 7 years from script to screen. So we're doing pretty quick.
See, Terrence Malick has a pretty small output.
Yes.
He's kind of fairly well regarded.
So every 20 years, isn't it?
Was there a certain pressure after winning that Oscar to come up with another project within a short time frame, given how fickle Hollywood can be?
Yeah, look, there was. We wanted to do a series next, 13 5-minute episodes for SBS, a little series called Urban Eccentrics, which we'd started writing, and SBS had given us some seed money. But then the Oscar thing happened, and we weren't planning for that. And suddenly there was a window of opportunity, and we thought, well, let's give it a go because, you know, you got to strike while the iron's hot and all this.
Yeah, and I literally actually sort of, you know, almost sort of tricked Adam into coming up with the feature idea because we had this US agent and manager, and they were like, you can't go around to the studios and pitch a 13 by 5 minute animated series. You just can't. Just come up with a feature idea. You never have to make it. So then I said to Adam, come on, we never have to make it. Come on, it'd be hilarious. We'll just go and, like, you know, how cool. We'll go to Disney and we'll see what that's like and blah, 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 blah. You know, and I promise you, we do not have to make it. But then, of course, by the time we'd pitched it all over Hollywood and they'd all politely declined, we'd sort of fallen in love with the idea and convinced ourselves, as, you know, often you do when you're publicising something, you say, make it sound so great, you go, gee, I think I'll buy one, you know. So that's sort of how we got ourselves into this awkward situation.
Just with winning that Oscar, was there a sense that it was... I mean, obviously it opened up a lot of doors, but do you think that it was sort of a blessing and a curse at the same time? Was there a sense that it...
Well, I
it
think...
It may have stopped you doing some of the things you wanted to?
My dad said to me, oh, it's all downhill from here. And...
So you're optimistic. Half empty kind of guy, obviously.
Yeah. You know, you've got nothing to aim for and you've won this too early in your career. And I look, with every film, I put all those awards aside, and I said to an interviewer up here in Sydney, I've got this big trophy cabinet full of awards at home, and I looked at it recently and thought, why aren't I happy? What's going on here? But I don't think we'd be sitting here if it wasn't for the Oscar. I think we'd have made something, but it may not have been a feature, and it may not have had Philip Seymour Hoffman in it, and it'd be probably something very different. So it does definitely, it doesn't come with a check, but it comes with opportunities.
And the thing is with Mary and Max, you've kept your voice. Now there isn't, because a lot of directors when they you know, go to Hollywood or they make it big, they start to get compromised. Now I'm assuming here that hasn't happened to you because I've seen Mary and Max and it does not feel like a compromised film. It retains your sort of dark tone, your very witty, often wicked sense of humour. You have to have, that has to be the most morbid director's cameo in Mary and Max I've ever seen, and I won't spoil it for the audience, but I had a good chuckle and I thought, I really like this guy's sense of humour.
I think it was really tough to go from the short format to the feature format, and I thought, oh, at first a feature would be like making four shorts all joined together, and of course it isn't. It's a different beast. It has a different rhythm and pace and different expectations. So the aim was, with the crew that we got, was to make sure that they were all on the same page as I was, that we all worked to the same vision. And as I said earlier, that they all had to learn my style and not go off on different tangents. And to keep make the film look like I had made it myself.
Yeah, and I think that's another important thing too, is that as the producer, kind of, you know, in getting people to finance the film, and protecting and supporting Adam, you know, and his, you know, style throughout the process, was it's really important to actually communicate what that was up front. And that's what we did. We didn't lie to anybody. You know, we did have US investors, but they were from New York. You know what I mean? Right. We were really upfront that we were independent filmmakers making an independent film that was stylistically different from other kinds of animation and so on and so forth. And I think that the combination of Adam having a very strong voice as a director, but also me consistently articulating it really clearly so that people knew what we were setting out to do. No one has looked at Mary and Max and gone, oh, gee, it's not what I thought.
Well, 63% of your $8.3 million budget was publicly funded. So, you know, that is an incredibly important thing, I imagine.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you know, the way the funding system worked at the time and to a certain extent still does work is you have to actually get a local distributor, so in Australia, an international sales agent. You actually have to prove yourself to the market in order to be able to access that taxpayers' money. So, and that's through what used to be called the Film Finance Corporation, it's now Screen Australia, SBS, Film Victoria, those kinds of organisations. And that's one of the things, those organisations it's so important. This film absolutely wouldn't exist without taxpayers' money. So thank you all very much.
Well, Mary Max admirably has a very local flavour to it as well. How important was that for you guys? I mean, you've used a crew of over 100, and admirably it's an all Australian crew that you've got there. In fact, half of it's filmed in, or set rather, in Mount Waverley, your hometown. I almost fell off my seat when I saw a clay version of Mount Waverley. It was fantastic.
No, I don't think anyone's ever attempted that. So,
yeah.
look, it was really important that the Mary's world was authentic, just as authentic as the characters. And so I suppose I'm Mary, but the palette, especially of Mount Waverley, was very brown. And to me, the 70s in Mount Waverley were very brown. Yeah. Everyone painted their houses mission brown and had cream carpet and macrame owls in their windows. And so we really wanted to make that world as real as possible. And it's funny because at Sundance Film Festival and in Berlin, several people come up and said, oh, that opening montage, and that's very, very German or very American. Really? I thought that was very Mount Waverley.
I think it's just very, very suburban.
Yes.
Of the 70s, right, you know.
Right. See, for me, that opening montage says more about Australian identity than all of Baz Luhrmann's films together. I mean, it's I know it's a big call, and I did actually steal it off a friend, so I should just put it out there right now.
But the tired swans, the football stuck on the roof, all of that.
The tennis shoes on the wires. Yeah.
That was my friend Michael Basley and I, who's helped me on Harvey Crumpet, we sat down and we just started writing a list of all the things that we remembered about our childhoods. And no one was really into very fancy gardens. Burke's backyard hadn't been invented yet. And so our backyard
was...
You've
been on it now.
I have been on it. And I still don't have it.
With his pot plant.
It was a pot plant that had cigarette butts and cat poo in it, but no plant.
I couldn't believe it.
But, so it was important to make that Australian, but not too Australiana. We didn't want it to be so kitsch that it would be repelling.
The film has shown at the Sundance Film Festival. It's also shown at the Berlin Film Festival. These are two of the biggest festivals in the world, really. It's quite incredible. I believe you had quite a different response from both audiences.
Yeah, well, at Sundance we were the opening night film and they'd never
show. No pressure.
No, not at all. And it's the first time an Australian film and an animation has opened the festival.
Yeah, it was doubly scary and double the pressure. And we'd only just finished the film. We hadn't had a proper test audience. It was all very scary and exciting, all rolled into one. And, of course, Robert Redford was there with us. And
No Botox.
And the...
It's the real deal.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
He's suggesting it needs
very
it.
Short.
He's very craggy, but he's still got it.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. And so that was that screening. And then Berlin was... it was different again because we were in the generation 14 plus category where the jury were aged 14 and we were seen as a kids film, which is because in Americans thought, oh, well, you know, well, they're still trying to work out what our film is.
Yeah.
We don't even know what our film is. We call it a comedy essentially, or a black comedy.
Yes. Yeah.
And in the kids section, we won a prize. The 14-year-old jury gave us a prize. And it was funny, the film they gave the Grand Prix prize to was called My Suicide. So it just shows the difference between the Germans and the Americans, and we're somewhere in between, I think.
Yeah. I think, as you say, your films are quite hard to, I guess, categorise or, you know, put into a box. I went to see Harvey Crumpet again the other day, and I went to my local DVD store, and I was like, where do I find it?
Exactly.
And it was in Art House, somewhere near Train Spotting, you know?
It's even ended up in the porn section at one place.
Because of the little plasticine penis.
Yeah, well, probably. I mean, I think one of the things about Adam's storytelling style is that it's about, you know, innocent characters in the complicated world in which we all live. So there are homeless people and, you know, drugs and suicide and, you know, all sorts of complicated things. But the characters are always innocent. So just as Harvey was an innocent in a complicated world, so Mary and Max are as well. And that's why sometimes people go, oh no, it's for kids because of the innocence of the characters, and then some people go, oh no, it's for adults because there's complicated issues, like, you know. I mean, Harvey Crumpet has assisted suicide in it.
Yeah,
you know, it was actually rated
M,
and Mary and Max is rated PG. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's less adult themes.
Right. Although, you know, the main one of the two main characters in Mary and Max has Asperger's, which is quite a confronting condition to people who know absolutely nothing about it.
Mm. And I guess you actually use, in a number of your films, your characters often have conditions or flaws, perhaps. Mm. You've explored Tourette's syndrome, you've gone to cerebral palsy, even thalidomide babies.
Mm.
What does that actually mean for your characters? What doesn't that sort of be expanded to, I guess?
Well, look, I never set out to have these type of characters. It's usually by, I sit down and think, right, I'm going to write a Finding Nemo thing that's going to make us millions of dollars, and by page three I have a thalidomide character. it's not deliberate. I write very intuitively. I write about the people around me. Mm-hmm. And with this film, I decided to write about my pen friend. And then I started writing it all down, and I thought, well, do I include his Asperger's? How could I not include his Asperger's? These are what I call clayographies. These are clay biographies, mm-hmm. and it's warts and all. I've got to talk about every part of him. And if I ignored his Asperger's, that would be, like in the line in the film, which my favourite line is, curing his Asperger's would be like trying to change the colour of his eyes. It's intrinsic in him. It's who he is. So, and also, at the College of the Arts, Sarah Watt was my animation lecturer, and she told us how it's an auteur's job to push the boundaries, and as a writer to really try and make films that you haven't seen before and present new material and take the art form in a new direction, because so much feature animation is formulaic and predictable, and it might be entertaining and that's great, but I want something else, and I've always wanted something else, and that's why I'm not a big fan of feature animation. I much prefer short animation, because there's really refreshing and exciting stuff in the short format. So that's what we wanted to do, was make what you normally get in shorts but put it in a feature without compromise, without losing the essence of our previous films.
And I think, too, there's a really strong theme through the film. We've been jokingly amongst ourselves calling it the antidote to the global financial crisis, because, we've lived in a society for so long that's kind of commodified everything. Like, everything's commodified. Like, even our romantic relationships are sort of commodified. Mm. But friendship is the one thing that we all can manage. We can all have a friend. We all usually do have friends. And when things go wrong in our lives, like, you lose your job or, financial problems or whatever, your friends are actually the people who sustain you. And I think that's why we feel the film is a really heartwarming and kind of uplifting film about how friendship is such a powerful force in all of our lives. Mm. And it's not something that's ever been kind of made cool or groovy. And so, for us, it's a really kind of strong theme in the film that, like, kind of doesn't matter how revoltingly different you are or you feel, that you still, can have, meaningful relationships in your life, and they don't just have to be about having a partner, for example.
And there is some happiness and beauty amongst all the hard times.
Absolutely.
Which, I'm just wondering, are you fans of the films of Rolf de Heer? Because his early work really reminds me of your work.
I look, Bad Boy Bubby.
Especially,
I was at, I think I was doing my year art and design TOP at Brighton Bay Secondary College, and I saw Bad Boy Bubby, and I saw that cat get wrapped in Glad Wrap. And I was, studying photography at the time, and I got one of my friends and wrapped him in Glad Wrap. And then I was also right into Peter Greenaway, and so I covered one of my friends who was very bald in snails. And so I had a very sort of, and David Lynch, of course. Yeah. I was watching Eraserhead, and I was much more into the darker live-action films and the sort of surrealist bent. And I wasn't into Ren and Stimpy and, I wasn't into all those cartoons. I was actually more into bleak, black material. Mm.
But I especially mention Rolf de Heer because he often does deal with marginalised people. Things like The Quiet Room and Dance Me to My Song and Bad Boy Puppies, the extreme. Mm. Yet there is this light and there is this beauty and hope and friendship that happens in the films towards
absolutely.
The end. And that's what I get from your films as well. There's a lot of sadness and pain, but there's this incredible joy of life that comes through all that.
Try and get a balance of light and dark.
Also you've got this great underlying message of tolerance and acceptance of everybody's differences.
Oh, sure, and that's one of the themes in the film, and I don't use the word disability at all. I just see that that everybody's imperfect. Everyone has a flaw, and it's really about empathising with my characters, putting yourself in Max's shoes and experiencing what it's like to have Asperger's syndrome. So the next time you encounter somebody with Asperger's, you have a, a slighter, better understanding of what it's like.
Well, I don't even view it as a flaw necessarily in his character, but just a point of difference in him. And you could replace that just as easily with, say, his sexuality or his religion or ethnicity.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's exactly right. Max's flaw isn't actually his Asperger's. His biggest flaw is that he's an overeater. And that's, well, I won't give it away, the film. But, you know, that's what I'm trying to do with all my films. So it's my second film, Cousin, and dealing with his cerebral palsy. He actually, my cousin, has more joy for life than I've ever had. So, yeah, and it's not about cerebral palsy.
Now, you've assembled a really impressive voice cast for this film. You've got Barry Humphries doing a brilliant job as the narration. Philip Seymour Hoffman voices Max. Tony Collette is the adult Mary. You've got Renee Geyer in there, Eric Barner, Molly Meldrum. You know, how important was it to attach some of these big names to the project in actually its fruition?
It was hilarious. I was at a Spa Fringe, Screen Producers Association Fringe conference, and this young man said to me, "So, like, did you like have to sell out?" I'm like, I kind of think that, you know, like, actually, you know, Adam and I created a dream list, and we got our dream list. It took a long time to, you know, get everyone, but we had a dream list. And I mean, you know, we're both massive fans of Toni Collette from Muriel's Wedding on. We're massive fans of Philip Seymour Hoffman. Everything, you know, Adam and I, we know it's a good film if we both like it, because we usually never agree on films.
The only film we've ever agreed on is Happiness. Work that out.
We're a little similar.
You both like it?
Yeah.
Yes, I love that
we
film.
We love it. So. Yeah. And you know, and so on. So it's been the only person who we really had to go and find was young Bethany Whitmore, who's a local Melbourne actress, who's 9 years old, and she was absolutely fabulous at Young Mary. But yeah, no, everyone else was on our wish list, and then, you know, it was my job to track them down and sign them up, and I managed.
I know that authenticity of the voice obviously is incredibly important to bringing the character to life. You know, obviously you've got Molly playing a homeless drunk in this. what qualities were you looking for the voice of Max?
Well, Max was probably the toughest, because he had to be the most authentic. And Max is Jewish, he's a New Yorker. He's very big, so we needed an actor who has a lot of bass to their voice. And Philip Seymour Hoffman really did pop into my head quite quickly. And he is also not notorious for doing animation. He's not like a Robin Williams or a Dustin Hoffman. Mm-hmm. He's actually got a lot of, you know, he's an actor's actor. And once we eventually got him, which did take a while, and I heard his voice and saw it with the character on the screen, I thought, oh, finally they marry. Because sometimes you can have a fantastic actor and some great animation, you put the two together and they just don't work for whatever reason. Mm. So, yeah, I mean, it was incredibly nerve-wracking, because we'd already signed him up, and, oh, God, thank God it did work. So yeah, you got to make sure they meld.
Not, yeah, I guess especially because like some of the other animated forms of films, they actually do the voices first, and then they adapt the characters to resemble the actors in some way to help with that. But you don't have that luxury in this.
No, we sort of did it all back to front.
We did actually do it both ways.
Oh, yeah.
But we weren't able to fit into Philip's schedule until much later. So that's originally the animators will tell you that the voice of Max for, you know, the 57 weeks of shooting was actually Adam. Yeah.
And they saw it all for the first time last week, and they were, I think they were a little bit disappointed that my voice had been dropped, which is quite, quite flattering. But.
And I sounded like this. No, but, you know, Philip was absolutely amazing. Yeah. And as Adam often says, it's that thing of when you're watching the film, you don't suddenly think of someone in a sound booth with headphones on talking into a microphone. You stay with the drama. That's one of the things that we wanted to keep, is to keep the audience watching the film and staying, continuing to follow the narrative.
Look, Adam, Melanie, you've made an extraordinary film. Thank you so much for, first of all, making this film for audiences all around the world to enjoy.
Thank you.
Listeners, bring a box of tissues with you. That's all I'm going to say. This is an immensely moving experience. It's a wonderful film. Thank you so much for taking the time to come into our studios today to speak with us.
It's great to be back.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Mary and Max opens through Icon Films on April 9. Support it right through the Easter long weekend.
Yes, please do.
Thanks again, guys.
Thanks.
You're listening to The Casting Couch on Joy 94.9.
This has been another Joy 94.9 podcast. Joy 94.9 is a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station committed to providing a voice for the diverse GLBTI communities. You can support our work by becoming a member or making a donation. For details, go to joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.